Hi, I'm Katrina Daniel, and welcome to Primetime Crime, a podcast for people who want to know what goes on behind the scenes of the most notorious trending crime stories and what's going on in the minds of those involved in those stories. What are the detectives, the judges, the defense attorneys, and the prosecutors thinking? You'll hear it all on Primetime Crime, the podcast. This is Primetime Crime. I'm Katrina Daniel, and many of us remember the blonde-haired, blue-eyed, baby-faced serial killer in Milwaukee, Jeffrey Dahmer. He killed 17 young men during his 13-year killing spree, and prosecutors say he ate some of their body parts. Ate their body parts. Ew. Back in 1991, Annie Schwartz was a young reporter on the dreaded overnight weekend shift at a local newspaper in Milwaukee. That graveyard shift, pardon the really bad pun, changed her life. She broke the story about Jeffrey Dahmer, one of the most gruesome, weird, sick serial killers ever. She wrote a book back then, and now Annie has just finished a reboot and is guaranteed to shock and raise some new questions about how Dahmer got away with killing so many young men for such a long time. It is my great pleasure to introduce my favorite reporter interviewee, Annie Schwartz, who 32 years ago wrote the definitive book on Jeffrey Dahmer, the cannibalistic serial killer, and she has just updated this book. And Annie, thanks for joining us. How'd you get involved with Jeffrey Dahmer?
I was the reporter that broke the story, Katrina. So we're talking about 30 years ago. I am the weekend cops reporter at the former Milwaukee Journal. There could not possibly be a less, you know, desirable beat when you are young than to be on weekend cops, because it's like 4 p.m. to midnight. You have no life. You can never go out with your friends. But I loved that beat because I knew that's where the good stories were. And I built a lot of good relationships with the police. I built a very strong relationship with them as my sources. And one of those sources called me on the night of July 22nd, 1991, and said, "Hey, we're at a really weird scene, Annie. This is," and his voice was kind of strange. It was an odd, you know, normally if they're going to mess with you, you can kind of tell. But he said, "This is really weird. It looks like this guy has been saving body parts in his apartment. And Rolf Mueller, a police officer, Rolf found a head in the refrigerator." So I'm, you know, there I am on the other end of the phone. And he said, "You got to get out here." And it's almost midnight. And I just, you know, there was something in his voice that told me I should go there. And I'll just see what this is. And if they're playing a joke on me, then they can laugh about that for a long time. And maybe somebody will owe me. So I went to the scene, and it was clear to me upon arrival that this was a crime scene unlike any other. People were standing outside, kind of huddled together. It was very quiet. Normally, those crime scenes are not quiet. People are yelling, or, you know, things are happening, but it was very quiet. It was eerie in that way. And when I got there, I was able to get into the building because I was there very early. I was there before any other media, and I was there really right when the detectives were just starting to arrive. So I was there very early, and I walked across the threshold of the apartment to stick my nose in to see what it looked like. That made a lot of commanders very unhappy that, yeah, I was given that kind of access, but it's not like anybody gave me that access. You know, everyone was so incredulous at what they were looking at. They're not worried about the you know, the blonde reporter that they're used to seeing at all the crime scenes. Because I went to everything.
It was Jeffrey Dahmer there at the time?
He was in the squad car by the time I got there. And I think they were already taking him downtown, getting him out of there. But I got to, you know, inside the apartment, just inside the threshold. I didn't take a tour. It was not like Parade of Homes. I just took a look in there, and it looked like a regular single guy's apartment. And Katrina, that's important to mention, because remember that only a couple of months earlier, Milwaukee police officers were in that same apartment and returned a young Conorak Citizen phone back to Dahmer, and then Dahmer later killed him. And the uproar from the public was, how could the officers not think something was weird in there? So the officers see this, and they, you know, there is nothing that leads them to believe that something awful is going on. But I take myself back to that night when I walked into that apartment and I didn't see anything that would lead me to believe that something untoward was going on there. Those officers originally were fired by the then police chief.
Really?
Yeah, they appealed it to circuit court. They got their jobs back because now this, we're taking you up to, you know, 2020, the word qualified immunity was used. So the judge back then said these officers made a mistake, but because of qualified immunity, you can't prosecute them. Now, 30 years later, we're still hearing that phrase when it comes to what kind of accountability are we using for our law enforcement. So the Dahmer case may be 30 years old, but a lot of the elements of it still hold true today. And that's why I did an update. The book ended when Dahmer walked out the door to prison. What happened in those ensuing years?
Capitalize the crime for us. Revisit it. Give us just the basics for people who aren't aware.
Jeffrey Dahmer was one of the most highly publicized, prolific serial killers in American history. He killed 17 men and boys in the quest to try and create kind of a zombie, or to create some kind of a lover that he could have that wouldn't expect anything of him. So his goal was not to find people to kill. His goal was to find men that he was attracted to bring them back to his home with him. All 17 of his victims went with him willingly. Nobody was kidnapped. Nobody was forced to come to his apartment. They all came with him willingly under the guise of having naked pictures taken of themselves for money, or to have sex with Dahmer for money. But what Dahmer wanted is he wanted to drug them and knock them out so that he could have sex with them in the way that he wanted, and he didn't have to worry about someone else's demands. So that is how we end up with 17 victims in a span of, 1978 through 1991.
Where would he meet these people, these victims?
He met a lot of the victims in gay bars in Milwaukee. So, he met them in the bathhouses. Sometimes he met them when he was just walking around a mall. We can't forget that serial killers are clever. They are, they're so clever that they remain undetected for years. I mean, Dahmer killed, between 1978 and 1991. Now, he didn't kill every single year, but I think in looking at the Dahmer case through the lens of 30 years later, we have to say, that the things that we know now just simply weren't present back then. The things that would be red flags now,
right,
were not red flags in the 80s and 90s. The gay community was so closeted in the city of Milwaukee, and you didn't come out. In fact, a number of the victims did not ever come out to their families. Families only found out about their secret life when these people died. And there remains one victim whose sister will probably, eat a large portion of cake over my grave if I die first, because she says, my brother wasn't gay. You can't, Dahmer must have abducted him. So imagine that your family member not only is killed by a famous serial killer, but now you find out something about them that you never, ever knew.
How does necrophilia play into this?
So as we're talking about Jeffrey Dahmer, we're talking about somebody that was searching for ways to keep people with him and to not be abandoned. And look, and you know, not every kid of divorce, you know, ends up murdering 17 people, but his, he really felt, he felt that strong sense of abandonment. And that is what a lot of the professionals described as the reasoning behind why he killed. So okay. He was looking to try and make these men a part of him. He was trying to get them to stay with him. But here's the thing. You can't keep a human body with you for very long. The body's going to decompose. You know, you're not going to be able to do that. So he was experimenting with ways to try to keep the person around. Dahmer almost always had sex with these victims after he had drugged them and they were passed out. Right. Because that is what he wanted.
Extreme passivity.
Extreme passivity. Don't ask me for anything. Don't ask when I'm going to call again. Don't ask if we're, you know, going to go see a movie this weekend. This is what he wanted. The necrophilia comes in because he had sex with these bodies after they were dead. The cannibalism was something he says he was curious about. And so he said he was experimenting. And that is what he told the court when he was asked about, you know, how did we come to find organs and body parts in the refrigerator, in the freezer? What was he going to do with them? And I think the answer is he didn't know, but he was experimenting. And he was looking for a way to make these men a part of him. He explained that one of the reasons that he ate the biceps of one of his victims is because that guy was so good looking. He was so strong. That's how that happens. Yeah, that's where Jeffrey Dahmer's mindset was, according to the forensic psychiatrist that talked to him for hours and hours.
How did he kill these young men?
He almost always killed them by first giving them some kind of a drug that put them to sleep. It's probably no small consolation to the families that the coroner doesn't believe that the victims suffered, because that was not what Dahmer was trying to accomplish. But he would drug them, and then he would strangle them. That's okay. How he killed most of his victims. A couple of the victims, he was experimenting with a very crude kind of a lobotomy process, thinking maybe he could keep them alive. He drilled holes in their heads and poured in muriatic acid see if he could make this, you know, unresponsive kind of partner for himself.
How did Dahmer plead? He pled not guilty. Why didn't he take an insanity plea?
He did. Dahmer did plead insanity. He used what's called a not guilty by reason of insanity, an NGI plea, when he went to court. So the trial that Dahmer went through was not a trial on his guilt or innocence. It was a trial based on whether or not he was insane. And that word gets us into an interesting discussion when it comes to Jeffrey Dahmer, because people like you and people like me look and say, wow, he is crazy because he did these things.
Yeah.
But the law doesn't look at it that way. The law says, here's the legal definition of insanity. And what the prosecutor, Mike McCann, did a really good job of was saying, look at all of the occasions, look at all the measures Dahmer took to conceal his crimes. This is not somebody who doesn't know what they're doing is wrong. This
right.
is someone who is concealing what they're doing, because he lied and concealed information with his probation and parole officer. He was lying to his family. He lied to his neighbors. He was trying to do things in the apartment that didn't make it, you know, smell so bad. Dahmer clearly knew what he was doing. And there were a number of people, and I talk about this in the new chapter in the book. There were people that visited him when he was in prison after the crimes, and he was asked point blank by both his defense attorney and by one of the cops that had gotten his confession from him, do you still have these urges? If you got out today, would you continue doing the same thing that you were doing before you were arrested? And without hesitation, Dahmer answered, yes. And some would say we don't have the death penalty in the state of Wisconsin, but in Jeffrey Dahmer's case, we kind of did. Because Dahmer was killed in prison less than 2 years after he was put there. And I was killed by another inmate.
Yep.
And there was talk that when Dahmer was being killed by this inmate, he really did not fight back. That there was perhaps a part of him that wanted to die. And the only person that knows that is Dahmer, of course. But this is the theory that is being expounded by different forensic psychologists and psychiatrists, that Dahmer was perhaps relieved to know that it was over.
Describe how Dahmer was killed and the circumstances. As far as I understand it, he and another inmate named Jesse Anderson were sent to scrub a floor someplace with another inmate named Christopher Scarver.
What's interesting about Jeffrey Dahmer and Jesse Anderson is Dahmer was finally let out into the general population. So he's no longer being kept from other inmates. He's no longer isolated from other inmates. And Jerry Boyle, his defense attorney, when I went and talked to him and we were remembering the time that Dahmer was murdered, during that time, Dahmer had told Jerry, they're going to put me in the general population and you know I'm not going to last there. So Jesse Anderson killed his wife and kind of mimicked the Charles Stewart case. So he told the police two black guys did it. That was his quote. And then he was later found to have been lying. He's the one that did the murder. So you have a guy that murdered his wife and blamed it on two black men. And you got a guy who murdered 17 mostly black and Hispanic men. And these are the two most high-risk prisoners in the facility. And they're both cleaning a bathroom.
What the hell were they thinking?
So these are the questions, Katrina. The questions that we have now are, you know, really was you know, this was one of those deals where apparently the guards in the pod are all talking together about somebody's hunting trip and they're not looking at the screen is what they told investigators. But that was the story. So Dahmer and Anderson are cleaning this bathroom. Christopher Scarver is crazy. He's serving a life sentence.
And he's got nothing to lose.
He's got nothing to lose. And I truly don't believe that Dahmer, one of the accounts that Christopher Scarver gives is he gives this account that Dahmer was taunting other inmates, that he would make shapes with his food. And I don't believe that happened. And most of the people that are familiar and clinically familiar with this case say, no, that was not in his makeup to do that. He wanted to be left alone. He didn't want the attention. This is not who he was. But Scarver, for whatever reason, took a barbell into the bathroom and beat Dahmer and Jesse Anderson to death. In the book, you'll see for the first time photographs of that crime scene. What I have and what I was given access to are photographs and crime scene information and evidence from Dahmer's murder. And that was very interesting because it was a completely unassuming box of stuff. You know, it's something that was almost, you know, forgotten about in the evidence locker where it sits.
Let's talk about Dahmer while he was still alive. Did you ever have a chance to interview him?
I didn't interview him, but I did get a call from him.
Really?
He was mad at me because your life as a crime reporter isn't weird enough until a serial killer is mad at you. And Dahmer reached out to me, called me at the TV station I was working at. And, you know, you have a collect call from an inmate at Columbia Correctional. And then it said, Jeffrey Dahmer in his voice. And I'm thinking, who is this, another deal where somebody's having fun with me? But no, it was Dahmer. And he was very matter of fact. Dahmer was not an interesting conversation. You know, he's not like, wow, I'd love to sit down and talk to him. He was not like Bundy in that way. Dahmer answered questions with either one or two word answers. He did not spend a whole lot of time explaining himself. He didn't embellish. It was yes or no, or exactly what you ask him. And so he called me with a reason. And the reason that he had called me was because he knew my book was out, and he knew that I would be doing a lot of interviews, and he knew that people would probably ask me if I had talked to him. And this is how manipulative he was. This is how smart he was. Because of course I'm going to tell people that I spoke to Jeffrey Dahmer. But he had called me only to say, the only person responsible for what I did is me. My parents weren't responsible. My family wasn't responsible. Nobody, society wasn't responsible. Nobody's responsible for what I did except me. And what he was angry about was that I had interviewed all these psychiatrists in the book who had said he's abandoned by the mother when he's little. His father knew that he had a thing for looking at the bones of animals and how they go together. All of these things were seen as flaws in the way that he was raised. And it was the one thing that it appears Jeffrey Dahmer cared about were his mother and father.
So really?
One thing it appears he cared about. So when there were stories out that said he was abandoned by his mother. His mother took psychotropic drugs while she was pregnant with him, took antidepressants while she was pregnant with him. Anytime there was a discussion about blame in this case, and it was with anyone other than Dahmer, he really was upset. He even testified about what happened the night the police came and returned Conorak's Synthesim phone, one of Dahmer's victims, back to him, only to be killed later because he was so good at manipulating them. So on the stand at his own trial, where he's trying to say he's insane, he's talking about, I talked to these officers. They didn't know what we were doing. It was to ascribe any normal emotion to Jeffrey Dahmer seems strange. But the one thing he cared about was his family.
How did Dahmer eventually get caught after killing 17 people?
He was about to kill his 18th victim, Tracy Edwards. But what happened is Dahmer was starting to get really sloppy. This is what happens in serial murder when they're close to getting count. They start to lose control. The bodies were literally piling up in Dahmer's house, and he was trying to... and he just could not fight the compulsion. So he brought Tracy Edwards back to the apartment with him. He was going to drug him, and he slapped a handcuff on him, and Tracy Edwards was able to get away. He ran out the door, and now he's running down the street in his underwear with a handcuff on, and he sees a squad. So two police officers, Milwaukee police officers, hey, this is something sort of strange. Stop and say, hey, which one of us did you escape from? Because they thought that maybe he ran away from an officer who was trying to arrest him. And Tracy Edwards starts to tell this kind of fantastical story about this place he had just been. And the officers decided to go back with him to see what was going on. The only honest interview Tracy Edwards probably ever gave was that night to the police, because he has embellished and gone on and on and on, as a lot of people associated with the case have gone on to say, oh, it was this, and oh, I saw this, and wow, it was weird, and he invited me for dinner, and the meat looked weird. I mean, none of that.
Yeah,
I don't believe any of that. But Dahmer was at first okay with the police because he had conned them before. However, the minute that the officers started to look a little deeper in the apartment, Dahmer started to fight with them. And that's when they started discovering the Polaroids were the first thing they saw. Dahmer had photographed using a Polaroid camera, had photographed his victims in various stages of dismemberment. He also would pose their bodies and take photographs of them. Then you've got a giant blue barrel in his bedroom filled with some kind of liquid, some kind of acid, because that was his solution for what he was going to do with all the bodies. He didn't know how he was going to get rid of them, so he decided he was going to try to melt them in this acid and then flush them down the toilet or drop them down the drain. And the officers are starting to find this stuff. One of the officers opened up the door to the refrigerator, and that's where he saw a human head on a plate.
Do you know that officer?
Yes. He recently died. He recently died, but he and I spoke periodically over the 30 years. And Rolf Mueller truly never recovered from that.
That's my next question. How can you unsee that? And you can't.
You can't unsee that.
You can't unsee that. Oh, I'm so sorry that happened to him.
And he and I talked, and he was affected with nightmares. He really struggled. And no one ever knew it because he never talked about it. His partner is the one that did all the interviews with media. Rolf really didn't want to. Because he was still processing this. So, you know, that's one of the sadder consequences. The other one is the two officers that had contact with Dahmer and returned one of his victims to him, only to see that victim killed and then four more after that.
Yeah.
So those officers are still around. They left the Milwaukee Police Department, and they both retired from law enforcement now. But one of them I still talk to quite often. And one of the things that he always says to me is, Jeffrey Dahmer ruined my life. Oh, Jeffrey Dahmer ruined my life because, you know, he will go over and over in his mind all the time what he saw that night. And he said, don't you think that I spend every day trying to figure out if there was something I could have seen or something that was weird or something we could have or should have done? When we hear the narrative of what happened that night with Dahmer and the boy, we have our own ideas about that. We weren't there.
Right.
These officers were there.
Yeah.
And these were not two guys with craven disregard for human life.
Right.
These were two busy cops who, when it was explained to them by a
calm, reasonable white guy,
right, they said, okay. And then they see the photographs. And as I say, you know, Katrina, the stories grow as time goes. What people saw that night, the women that you know, ostensibly saw something, their perceptions of that, they have changed and they've evolved over the years. And that, I guess, is going to happen. But what has not changed is the fact that those two officers absolutely wish that night wouldn't have happened. But look who gave them their explanation.
Why did you decide to revisit and write a sequel?
A lot of people will ask me about the Dahmer case, and they usually want to know the details of the case from back then. But then I noticed that people also were asking, and I started thinking about what has changed in 30 years. And one of the things that made me think about that was the George Floyd case, because now there are people are really taking a look at law enforcement. And they're looking at law enforcement and saying, you know, they're talking about white privilege. They're talking about qualified immunity. A lot of these things came up. And people were starting to say, well, just look back at some crimes historically. And Dahmer was one of the crimes that people were mentioning. So I thought, let's take a look at the 30 years that have ensued. Let's see how the prosecutor, how the defense attorney, let's see how the principals in this case have lived in the 30 years since Dahmer. What are their observations about 30 years later? And we cover everything. I went to the medical examiner who did the autopsies on all the victims. And I asked him what his takeaway is 30 years later. I talked to the district attorney who prosecuted the case and talked to Dahmer's defense attorney. 30 years later, What are your thoughts? You know, we're now seeing, you know, television shows like Dexter, where you have a main character who's a serial killer and they're acting this stuff out on television.
Yeah, exactly.
And so now we have a society that's getting kind of inured to this. God, I hope we're not, but that's what's starting to happen because it's out there all the time. It's kind of like, you know, sex on cable, right? What can you show? One of the people I go back to is a young producer that I worked with back in 1991. She is now the managing editor at the TV station 30 years later. And we talked about what was it like back then to try to figure out what discussions were we having, trying to figure out what in the hell are we going to put on TV? What can we put on the air for the general public to hear? Well, that discussion would be very different 30 years later. You know, I watched the coverage of the murder of Gabby Petito. And one of the things that people are talking about is I'm seeing lots of medical examiners who were interviewed on TV talking very specifically about what happens to the human body and how, you know, what kinds of things will you do in the autopsy to figure out how she died.
Yeah.
We used to talk about that stuff on television. My gosh, in the 90s, we didn't even show a vaccine needle going in someone's arm because you get all kinds of calls from, you know, the audience saying, don't show that. That's awful.
Yeah.
So there is a look back to be had 30 years later. And that is what I did. And I include my own observations 30 years later as well. So it's also a book that now appeals to a new audience. Because as we have discussed, you know, you're 30 years after the case, you've got people that don't even know, you know, what that case is about. It's also going to be available this time on an audiobook so people can hear me read it. It's written in the first person. It's my journey going through the case. And then what is the journey 30 years later to go back?
Annie Schwartz, it was a pleasure talking to you, even though the subject is really gruesome. What's the title of the new book? What's the release date? And how can people get it?
The new book is called Monster, The True Story of the Jeffrey Dahmer Murders by Annie Schwartz. It is coming out October 26th of 2021, just in time for Halloween, but I had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, sure.
But thank you for having the conversation, Katrina. I think it's important that we talk about these cases. A lot of people don't want to anymore. They want it to go away, but it doesn't go away.
Thanks for listening to Primetime Crime, the podcast. Follow us on Facebook at Primetime Crime and on Instagram and Twitter at PrimetimeCrime_. Post your comments and tell us what true crime stories you'd like to hear about. Subscribe to Primetime Crime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts. Thanks a lot.